Good morning.
Good morning.
You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honor. In the District Court, Mr. List, Assistant Attorney General, here on behalf of the athlete of the state of Nebraska. We've assigned three errors in our petition for further review. Time permits, we'll address all three. First assignment of error is that the Court of Appeals erred by mandating an incorrect procedure for addressing post-conviction motions, which alleged the trial counsel failed to file a direct appeal. The Court of Appeals held that when addressing such a motion, the District Court should take up the direct appeal claim first and then take one of two courses of action. The first course of action is that if the direct appeal claim is granted, the remaining post-conviction claims should be denied as premature. The second course of action is that if the direct appeal claim is denied, the District Court should reserve ruling on that direct appeal claim and enter a single final order disposing of the direct appeal claim with all the remaining post-conviction claims.
Counsel, you're aware that one of your colleagues argued this very issue before us in a case a month ago.
Yes.
And she articulated what her perspective was as to what the rule is, and I confess at the moment I have to go back and look at my notes to see what it was. Are the two of you on the same page?
We are, Your Honor.
And can you tell us what should be the rule?
Yes. Our position is that the correct procedure when a direct appeal claim is denied is that the District Court should enter a final appeal order on that direct appeal claim only before moving on to address any of the remaining post-conviction claims. We submit this is the correct procedure for four reasons. The first reason is that it turns out that the defendant expressly told his counsel not to file a direct appeal. Well, then under State v. Cartwright, the defendant has waived his or her right to a direct appeal, and all those remaining post-conviction claims are procedurally barred.
Okay, so now that's where the District Court denies an evidentiary hearing on that claim?
If it, right.
Okay.
Yes.
So if it grants an evidentiary, yeah, I understand what you're saying. If it denies an evidentiary hearing on that claim, it shouldn't address any of the other claims.
Right.
And then once the appeal time goes by, if there's no appeal or appeal is taken and it's disposed of, the others either will go away or then be considered on their merits, right?
Right. Well, the first point we're making is that if you take up that direct appeal claim first,
right,
and that direct appeal claim was waived because the defendant told counsel not to do it, then all the other claims are procedurally barred. They're automatically gone. And
right.
So at that point, there's no point in doing anything other than addressing the direct appeal claim. And the same rationale would hold true if the defendant waives.
You mean, are you talking about trial error, those claims, or are you talking about other post-conviction claims?
Any claims that could have been raised on post or on direct appeal would then be barred.
Okay.
The same rationale would hold true if a defendant waives his or her right to a direct appeal on post-conviction as part of a plea agreement, as the defendant recently did in the Dye case. In that situation, just as in a Cartwright-type situation, the defendant's post-conviction claims are barred, and there's no point in doing anything other than addressing the direct appeal claim. The second reason we submit that a district court should enter a final appealable order on the direct appeal claim only before moving on to the remaining post-conviction claims is that it will help prevent confusion as to the status of the remaining post-conviction claims. Take this case, for example. District Court denied all of Dieterman's post-conviction claims without an evidentiary hearing, other than the direct appeal claim, which is still pending for an evidentiary hearing. Well, at this juncture, the Court of Appeals has reversed and remanded for an evidentiary hearing on the direct appeal claim without conducting any appellate review on the claims that were denied without an evidentiary hearing. So we go back for this evidentiary hearing on the direct appeal claim, and a new direct appeal is granted. Where do we stand with respect to the claims that have already been denied by the District Court without an evidentiary hearing? We haven't had appellate review on that, on those claims. Are they fully litigated?
And that was the case we had last month, essentially.
Yes, and I think you're dealing with it again here potentially too, because we haven't had appellate review on the claims that were denied without an evidentiary hearing.
Well, if you hadn't addressed the direct appeal, the post-conviction claims wouldn't be ripe, would they?
I'm sorry?
If you hadn't decided the direct appeal issue, the post-conviction claims then wouldn't be ripe for decision. Because you can't make those decisions until you determine what's going to be the outcome of the direct appeal.
Well, but
yeah, if he's reversed and remanded for a new trial, there's no post-conviction claims remaining.
True. Okay. All the more reason to, again, start with just the direct appeal claim and go do the direct appeal first. Third reason we submit a district court should do a final appealable order on the direct appeal claim only before addressing the remaining post-conviction claims is that it will ensure defendants are not denied the right to appeal in the event a direct appeal claim is denied without an evidentiary hearing. For example, if the district court does its initial review of a post-conviction motion, doesn't grant an evidentiary hearing on the direct appeal claim and grants an evidentiary hearing only on one or more of the remaining claims, that will in effect be a denial, or at least an implicit denial, of that direct appeal claim without an evidentiary hearing. And under our current case law, the defendant would have to appeal from that order in order to seek appellate review when there's not going to later be jurisdiction to do so. We think, again, just starting with the direct appeal claim will avoid that problem and that confusion. The fourth and final reason we submit a district court should start by addressing a direct appeal claim only is that it will provide a single and straightforward procedure for all of us to follow. There won't be confusion as to whether a district court should do what the district court did in this case, whether it should do the single final order theory that the Court of Appeals has suggested, or whether it should do what we're advocating and start with only the direct appeal claim. We'll have a single, straightforward procedure, and it will hopefully ensure that we don't encounter all of this confusion and potential problems discussed.
And help me again by what's your view of how you would distinguish what you're advocating for from what the Court of Appeals did?
The Court of Appeals is saying, don't take up that, or if you deny the direct appeal claim, don't enter an order on it, a final appealable order on it immediately, and let that go up on appeal and get finally resolved before I move on. The Court of Appeals says reserve ruling on the direct appeal claim if you're denying it, and later enter a single final order disposing of that direct appeal claim along with all the remaining post-conviction claims so that we can just have one appeal. And we disagree. We disagree with what the district court did in this case, and we also disagree.
That would certainly, that clearly, the way you postured that would clearly not make the post-conviction claims ripe for determination if the person were granted a new direct appeal. You couldn't rely on the decisions on the other post-conviction claims if you went back for a determination of the direct appeal and it was reversed and remanded for a new trial.
In which case, again, there's no point in taking those other claims until right. We resolve the direct appeal claim. Our second sign of error, Court of Appeals prepared by mandating that this new procedure entering a single final order should apply in all post-conviction cases in which an evidentiary hearing is to take place. We submit this is incorrect for three reasons. First, it conflicts with our well-established and long-standing law that the district court has to enter a final appealable order when it denies claims without an evidentiary hearing. Second, it will potentially lead to the problems discussed about claims being implicitly denied in defendants, being denied an opportunity to seek appellate review. And third, it will potentially lead to multiple evidentiary hearings. Say a district court does this and holds an evidentiary hearing on one or more claims, denies the remaining claims without an evidentiary hearing, then it comes up on appeal and the appellate court says, well, you should have held the evidentiary hearing on some of those other claims that were denied without an evidentiary hearing. At that point, it's going back for a second evidentiary hearing in the case. We submit this is not the correct procedure. The correct procedure is the one that we have in place, which ensures that only one evidentiary hearing takes place in any given case. There's no reason to depart from that procedure. Our final sign of error is that the Court of Appeals erred by reversing this case for failure to apply a new procedure. We submit that if a new procedure is announced in this case, it should be purely procedural. It should apply only prospectively. The district court in this case already addressed several of these claims and rejected those claims. We see no reason that they shouldn't be addressed in this appeal. We submit they should be addressed and fully litigated before we go back and the evidentiary hearing on the direct appeal claim. That way, if a new direct appeal is granted, those claims are already fully litigated. We're not wondering whether or not they have been. If there are no further questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
Do you have a dog in this fight?
Kinda, no. Not a lot of skin in the game, but I'll do my best. And so, my name is Jeff Gerritig. I am making my appearance on behalf of Aaron Dieterman, the defendant.
Excuse me, for the record, the yes. Chief Justice will be proceeding, or will participate on briefs, as will Justice Miller Lerman, and Justice McCormick will not be participating.
Thank you. Again, Jeff Gerritig making my appearance on behalf of Mr. Dieterman. The issue before the court is what to do when defendant's right to a direct appeal has been effectively denied as a counsel's failure to protect you.
Counsel, I want to ask you a question, and in part I want to ask it so I give Mr. Liss a chance to address it when he comes back. He suggests, you heard what he suggested in terms of the procedure, and he suggests that that would result in one and only one evidentiary hearing. It seems to me that there's still the possibility of two evidentiary hearings if the trial court holds an evidentiary hearing solely on the failed direct appeal claim, and after the evidentiary hearing concludes that believes the lawyer says, who said, I was asked. Anyway, it goes up on appeal and somehow is reversed. It comes back down. Then the trial court has to go on to the other post-conviction claims, right?
That's how I would understand it.
But that's a pretty small likelihood, isn't it?
I believe in the grand scheme of things, I would agree.
Because the odds are pretty good if a trial court holds an evidentiary hearing and it's a question of he said, or he said, she said sort of facts, the odds are pretty good. The trial court's probably going to believe the lawyer as opposed to the person sitting in prison?
That's correct. I think it goes to a question of credibility and also documentation, obviously, oral or written requests or waivers.
So I've interrupted you a lot, and I want to give you a chance now to weigh in on what the state thinks we ought to do in terms of this procedure.
Well, I don't necessarily disagree with Mr. Liss and the state. I think what we're looking for is direction or guidance as to, in the specific case of my client, Mr. Dieterman, you can see his dilemma in this case. Of course, specific and individual to him, but obviously applies perhaps to all. And so, Mr. Dieterman, what we have here is, I think I referenced the term in the Court of Appeals, is almost like an appellate purgatory, where he is attempting to, file an appeal, and then he has to, as a prophylactic measure, on behalf of Mr. Dieterman, I file the appeal on the denial of his claims, and so that goes up, and then it's almost like we're on two battlegrounds. I'm Court of Appeals, and I'm in district court with Judge Johnson, but Judge Johnson's jurisdiction's been suspended or abated, and so, frankly, we're confused. Frankly, a lot of practitioners out there is we're looking for some direction. And I don't believe that the Court of Appeals got it wrong. I think they took their opinion in order and expanded it, and it was a pronouncement that was for the bench, if you will.
You would agree that the Court of Appeals approach differs from that that's being advocated by the state.
Yes.
And of those two approaches, I know you sort of prevailed, I guess, to a degree with the Court of Appeals, and you don't want to criticize them, and I understand that. They're fine judges trying to do their best with a difficult situation. But putting aside that they've invested in that and you're invested in it, if you had to pick one starting from scratch, which approach would you pick?
Well, I think they both have merit. Yeah, I don't want to sound like a politician, and I don't feel, to defend the Court of Appeals, but I think Mr. Liss and the state they're on to something. I think that we need some direction. I think either way would be fine. I think what we have now is there. I do agree with Mr. Liss. We have whether we have confusion going forward, we have confusion now as a parent, and so we've got to see something that would help us. But I think both can work if I had to pick one.
And now another question that is really addressed to both of you. Assume we adopt Mr. Liss's and the state's advocacy that says we direct the trial court should only address the direct appeal denial claim first and enter a final order on that and not enter a final order on any of the other claims until that order becomes final, one way, by failure to appeal or by appellate resolution. And let's suppose a district court out there somewhere doesn't read our opinions very carefully and goes ahead and violates that. What should we do in that circumstance?
Well,
it's still an appealable order, isn't it?
Yeah, it'd still be an appealable order. I still think that there would be the option to do what I did in this case and appeal. You still have to have your right or opportunity to appeal, and so there would still be, I think, a remedy, an appellate remedy. So,
but what we would then do is say you didn't read our opinions and vacate what the trial court did and say hold off until you've entered a final order on the direct appeal.
That would be probably the proper approach. I think on behalf of Mr. Dieterman, of course, he would just want some direction, and you know, he wants to have his, I guess, when you say day in court, at least his right of appeal, I think. So where we're at with Mr. Dieterman is trying to have this issue resolved so that we can go back down with Judge Johnson in Saline County and then have the evidentiary hearing and then have an actual pronouncement, because in some cases, then, I agree with Mr. List, would be granted the evidentiary hearing, and if there is evidence or ruling that there should be a direct appeal, and then that would be the best way to proceed. Here, like I said, I filed the appeal as a prophylactic measure because I was concerned in the sense that if what happened here was that they granted the evidentiary hearing on the failure to direct appeal, and of course we're not going to have that evidentiary hearing within 30 days, and the other claims are denied, I've got to file the appeal, or else I'm concerned on behalf of my client that he's going to lose forever those appellate issues. And so it was a placeholder prophylactic measure to do so, get in front of the Court of Appeals, and it really isn't a substantive argument. They noticed and spotted the issue, became a procedural problem, if you will, and that's when, of course, you know, they took the Seeger case and they expanded it, and instead of making it permissive or more, you know, this is a best practice, if you will, in Seeger, they made it, of course, as you know, mandatory.
One more joint question, and that is, if we were to adopt the state's approach as to how this should be done, would we be affecting or would we need to do anything with the actual judgment entered by the Court of Appeals? Could that stand the way it is, even though we're tinkering with the rationale and perhaps advocating a different approach than the Court of Appeals used, but would we need to change the actual judgment, the actual disposition of these claims that was made by the Court of Appeals?
I think you might. I think you'd have to go back, and that would be a certain possibility. I'm not sure, to be honest with you.
Remind me what the Court of Appeals did with those claims.
They, as far as on appeal, you know, as far as the judgment vacated, case remanded for further proceedings, they didn't address it.
So they vacated the...
The earlier...
the district court's order.
And then for denying the cause for not having an evidentiary hearing, they dismissed, they vacated that. But, of course, by doing so, I don't think they really addressed, though, the substantive.
Thank you.
If any, no further questions, I do thank you for your time.
How much time for...
He has a minute, 17.
Let's jump to a couple of your questions here, Mrs. Castle. As far as your question about the possibility of there really being two evidentiary hearings in the event that we do, state's advocating to start with the direct appeal claim. That's true, but we think it's worth it in that scenario to just have a clean and straightforward procedure and to avoid the potential confusion and problems of these other remaining claims to just get this resolved, even though it would potentially lead to two evidentiary hearings. We do think it's worth it.
So if the trial court is faced with a claim for a new direct appeal and also other ineffective assistance or constitutional claims, you're saying the trial court should just address the direct appeal question first and then have that proceed through its course, and then if there is necessary hearings for the other post-conviction claims, then have that after the direct appeal issue is resolved?
Exactly.
Okay.
To a final appeal board.
I think I finally understand everything you're talking about now.
The other thing, for that last question you posed.
About the judgment, yes.
Yeah, about what should this court do. The Court of Appeals did vacate the district court's judgment on those claims.
So we should affirm that.
Well, I guess we're not particularly concerned with what you do on that. Again, we do think that this, if you announce a new rule, it would be procedural, and that there's no reason to really unravel the district court's claims. It should just apply prospectively. Affirm the district court's, if that's what you're asking, affirm the district court's denial of those claims.
That's not what I was.
Okay.
I was saying we ought to, suggesting whether, or asking really, whether we ought to affirm the Court of Appeals vacating of the district court's decision denying those claims.
I understand. Our position is that at this point, because it, in our view it would be a procedural rule, we should just affirm the district court's denial of the claims denying that evidentiary hearing and have this fully litigated and be done. But alternatively, if you were to affirm the Court of Appeals judgment and send it back with directions to apply this new procedure, the direct appeal claim start fresh. We don't have a particular problem with that.
The actual outcome of the Court of Appeals judgment would be consistent with the approach that you're suggesting, correct?
If you were to do that, to send it back with instructions to start with the direct appeal claim and the direct appeal claim only, and have those other claims be vacated and then be up and running as we're advocating, yes, that would be consistent.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
No further questions. Thank you.
Thank you. The next case is State versus Perry. Chief Justice and Miller Lerman will be participating on briefs, and Judge Inbody of the Court of Appeals will also be sitting.